I'm Richard Kilgariff. Welcome to the Bocomi podcast. We're getting smarter, faster, together with original, memorable insights. OMI, from the most wanted new books across business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode, we look at leadership through the lens of elite sport.
My name's Tom Young, performance psychologist and author of The Making of a Leader. And this is my OMI for Bocomi.
How high performance on the field or track is often the result of intuitive or learned leadership methods that can be applied to your own behavior at work.
You know, how do you get a group of people aligned with a vision so it becomes more of a shared initiative than something that is just being driven by one man or one woman?
Tom Young is a performance psychologist who works with teams and individuals to get the most out of themselves and the people around them. His book, The Making of a Leader, What Elite Sport Can Teach Us About Leadership, Management and Performance, is the result of observing sporting leaders in high-pressure environments, noting how they communicate, how they handle pressure, maintain focus and respond to challenges. Tom, welcome to Bocomi.
Hi guys, thanks for having me.
The title of the book, The Making of a Leader, this implies you don't think leaders are born with leadership traits. Can anyone be a leader then?
I think to a certain extent they can. I mean, there's lots of research around, say, for instance, personality. So are we born a certain way or do we develop it? The whole nature-nurture debate. I've kind of settled that I think that it is a combination. I think we are born with some traits, but we also develop them over a period of, you know, our experiences, our thoughts, our emotions, the people we kind of encounter along the way as well. I think early on in leadership theory, there was kind of assumption that leaders were born. And, you know, there was this trait theory, which is all around kind of people are born with certain traits that lend them to leadership and wisdom and things like that. So, you know, I think people that are influential due to charisma or genetics, and that leaders are born and not made. And I think that kind of thinking has evolved. I think we're a combination now. I think in the past, maybe leadership was reserved, or maybe this still lingers, that we assume leadership is reserved for people who are quite assertive, extrovert, those charismatic leaders. Whereas I think today, now we're seeing more people who are emotionally intelligent, in tune with relationships, looking at how they can communicate with different personality types. So moving away from maybe that, if we call it the charismatic leader approach, to something that's a little bit more authentic and a little bit more, you know, how do you get a group of people aligned with a vision so it becomes more of a shared initiative than something that is just being driven by one man or one woman? So I think predominantly my answer, if it was going to give a quick answer, I would say made. But of course, there are traits that we're born with that dictate maybe what our leadership style might be. But there are lots of leadership styles out there.
That nature-nurture debate is fascinating, isn't it? And it's not a binary thing, leadership, is it? It's something that exists in the moment. And you talk to a range of leaders in football for the book, particularly, notably Sean Dyche, Roberto Martinez, both of whom have had similar but different tasks on their hands at club and country level, leading and managing players at the top of their game. And it made me think about my personal obsession with, as most things do, with Brian Clough and his time at Leeds in the 70s, how he couldn't win the top players over with the same methods he used at the less starry Derby County. How should a leader in sport or business behave when suddenly in charge of big egos or other people who consider themselves influential?
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's a really good question. I think, I mean, Brian Clough, I'm a little bit young to kind of be an expert in Brian Clough, but obviously Sean Dyche played briefly under him as well as a youngster at Nottingham Forest. And I think one of his words was, you can't help but be affected by someone with that kind of personality. In terms of dealing with those egos, I think the first thing you've got to remember is they're human beings first. And that comes out throughout all the interviews, really. It's about understanding people. And quite often we perceive people as having these big egos and maybe also having kind of bulletproof confidence that comes with that sometimes. You know, you start thinking about maybe your maverick players or your kind of special players, X-factor players. But actually they are human beings first and foremost, and we all have limiting beliefs. We all have things that hold us back as well as that drive us forward. So fundamentally, it's about understanding that individual. I mean, Dyche talks about Joey Barton, who's a kind of contrasting character in many ways and currently managing Fleetwood. But he talked about just speaking openly, honestly, what's the relationship going to be like? What's he going to provide as a player? What are the club going to provide as an organisation and as a culture? And speaking quite openly and honestly. With those people, you do have to get their buy-in because they are influential in the dressing room. So one of the areas we talked about was how you get those players to buy into what you're trying to do. So definitely, I think central to that is relationships and understanding the human being, because we talk about, you know, those egos, but what is the basis of that ego? What is their journey? You've got to understand that that individual has a unique collection of experiences of good and bad and thoughts and emotions. And you've really got to understand that person in order to build the relationship.
Yeah, Joey Barton's a great example, isn't he, with Sean Dyche, where I think the phrase you recount in the book is that he treated him like a man instead of a boy. And therefore, Joey Barton raised himself and his game and his attitude and his behaviour to the level of his own expectation to be more responsible and in the dressing room.
Yeah, and I think with that example, I was lucky that obviously Joey Barton's book was written with Michael Calvin, and he actually does quite a lengthy piece in his book where he's looking at his own personality, and he's referring to a behavioural profile he did at the club with Sean Dyche, which is part of how he understands people. But yeah, man, not a boy. I think you've got to look at the stage that you've, you know, that Sean Dyche was taking Joey Barton as a player. Almost as, I think Joey talks about taking me as the finished article. And from that, he doesn't mean perfect, but he's not really going to change at 33, 34. And he's not that young kid in his 20s who's obviously made mistakes along the way. And I think he obviously admits to that. So it's about speaking to him as a man. I think the media were asking, how are you going to manage Joey Barton? And it kept cropping up in press conferences. And I think Sean Dyche, you know, he talks actually, it was quite simple, their interaction. This is what you're going to get from me. This is what I expect from you. And if that all stays in line, then we're going to do well. And it gave him that responsibility and it gave him that voice in the dressing room. And he loved his time there. And when you hear him talk about it, he loves looking back on it. And I think there's one quote in the book that or in Joey's book, where he refers to Sean Dyche, he's probably one of the only managers that I still call a friend. And that speaks volumes of their relationship.
So that's friendship and that's connecting with people. But learning to deal with success and failure is a big part of leadership. And the right decision can often have the wrong outcome because of luck or external factors. Now, I think rugby is a great theatre for this to play out with its deep-rooted cultures and expectations. How would you compare and contrast, for instance, the leadership styles or philosophies of, say, Stuart Lancaster and Eddie Jones at England with Michael Maguire, the New Zealand coach?
That's a really, I mean, obviously, so in the book, we interview Stuart and we interview Michael, or Madge, as I might call him through these interviews. I think it's quite, you know, you look at Eddie Jones taking over from Stuart. I think what comes across from Stuart's interviews, first of all, he's very, very open, honest, authentic, all those kind of words that you would associate with him. If you see his interviews, you would just think he's a really decent person, decent human being, and probably does embody those values. So very big on values, very big on culture. And I interviewed him initially ahead of the 2015 World Cup. And my second interview was almost going full circle after he'd left England, joined Leinster, and they won the European and domestic double. So I was lucky to have two interviews with Stuart. And I think he was really big on the culture. It was about, that has to be there. I think he said, you know, if you don't have that culture, then you can't withstand those challenges. And in the fallout of that World Cup, you know, you talk about you can make the right decisions and it's the bounce of a ball and it's luck. There is an element of that. You know, you prepare the players and then you are kind of in their hands in many ways. But at the same time, the book does stop with the leader. That's the way that elite sport goes. I think Eddie Jones has... and I haven't interviewed Eddie for the book. I've heard him speak a number of times. And I think he was able to come in and build on the foundation that Stuart had built and had created in coaching a lot of those players from a young age, people like Owen Farrell, George Ford. I think he'd coached those guys in the Saxons. So they had a good base of talent and character. But Eddie can come in and probably be a little bit more direct, a little bit more aggressive, shall we say. But at the same time, if you listen to Eddie Jones speak in the aftermath of this World Cup that we've just had, you'll hear him talk about things like performance relationships, so getting to understand the individual. So I think even in that way, even though those two contrast with one another in certain ways, and that's probably worked for high performance in terms of Eddie, I think Eddie himself has probably softened a little bit in terms of being able to acknowledge the individual characters within the group. Michael Maguire over in Australia, so he was with the South Sydney Rabbitohs when I interviewed him, and they were coming off the back of their first win in the grand final in, I think, over 40 years. So they'd made history. And Madge is very, very tough. He's very kind of, he's physically imposing. And he's also massive on that culture in terms of behaviours, so standards, and not overstepping the line. But also there's an undercurrent of care with him that maybe you wouldn't necessarily see in a media interview or in that public persona. But there is a real kind of family value within the clubs that he looks to instill. So culture's big for all of them, I would say, but they do it in their own way. Culture effectively is the aggregate of people's behaviours within that organisation. It's something that we might sometimes over-intellectualise in sport. You know, we make it sound more complicated than it is. It's easy to talk about, but you've got to layer it on a longer term basis, if that makes sense. You've got to constantly build on it. It's not something you can just do in a PowerPoint or a 1 hour presentation to a load of players. It's something you've got to constantly refer back to and reaffirm, if you will.
It's very interesting, isn't it? You can't just put a poster up and say, this is our culture.
No.
And I think that example of Stuart Lancaster and Eddie Jones is really interesting because Stuart Lancaster, as you say, put in place, probably laid the foundations of the culture in the first place, and it was a different type of leader, maybe more of a manager, really, than Eddie Jones is. Maybe more transformational than transactional, I don't know. Or yeah, they're two different styles. They could actually work together at the same time, couldn't they?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, I think if you look back at pictures of Stuart during that kind of period with England, I think one of the things he will have done quite openly is he'll have trusted his assistants and delegated to his assistants to coach, because they're all brilliant coaches. So I think Graham Rowntree, Andy Farrell, who's obviously now with Ireland, they've gone on and done great work. So he'll have trusted them to do the kind of on the grass coaching, because he talked a lot about the other commitments that come with the RFU. So committees, execs, management boards, other clubs, sponsors, all those kind of things. You become almost a leader of an organization rather than leader of a team. And that takes you away from that, probably the core of his skill set, I think he would readily say, is grounded in teaching and is grounded in coaching. And I think it speaks massive volumes that when he went to Leinster, that you know, players like Johnny Sexton, I think he was World Player of the Year at the time, were kind of proactively reaching out, saying, you know, are you going to come? Because they were excited at the prospect of working with him. So I'm not sure about the manager-leader thing there, because manage, you know, is about kind of almost controlling other people. And in some ways, it's a little bit more about processes, and leadership is maybe a little bit more aspiring. So I'm not sure on that one. But I think fundamentally, he'll have probably spent 20% coaching the team and 80% looking after other things versus now at Leinster. Remember, he's a senior coach at Leinster. He's not head coach. I think Leo Cullen is the head coach. So Stuart has kind of much more responsibility now for being on the grass. And one of the things he said to me that after he did leave the England job, after a period of reflection, one of the things he went back to doing for a short period was just coaching grassroots rugby, just getting back to that time on the grass, which I think gives a real insight into his mentality and his own philosophy around coaching, because it's about developing players. And he said, if I didn't go back into professional coaching, I'd go back to being a teacher.
Really interesting, that comparison with working life and cultures as well, because sometimes people who are successful through their career get promoted away from what they're really good at. And leadership doesn't have to be the person at the top of the organization, does it? You can be a leader within the sphere of your influence in a company and then get taken away from it into another sphere of influence where you're not as effective.
Definitely. I think we see that quite often. I think people get promoted or rewarded, if you will, because of their, say, management and because of their skill within their role. And you step up into a leadership role and the demands are different. And, you know, people struggle to delegate, maybe, for instance, because they're used to being in control of certain things. And one part of leadership is you have to let go a little bit and you have to be vulnerable enough and trust other people enough to do that. So I think that's a massive part. I think we've probably all been in teams where or lots of people have been in teams when one person's, if we're using the sporting analogy, got the armband. So they're the captain in name, they're doing the coin toss, they're shaking hands, doing all that stuff. Whereas actually the real leader, or the leader that people actually talk, kind of turn to under pressure, doesn't have the armband, but they lead by example, or they lead through hard work, or whatever that might be. And I think we see that in businesses as well. You don't have to have the title in order to lead. And I think that's something that, you know, people often say, well, I need to develop my leadership style, or I wish I could be more, I don't know, extrovert, or be more confident in the decisions I make. Sometimes it's about finding your leadership style, not kind of aspiring to somebody else's or to an image of leadership that we've picked up through our experiences. So definitely you see that all the time. But I would say leading by example is a massive part of you know, if you look at someone like N'Golo Kante at Chelsea, you know, quite quiet. I think he's quite shy. When you look at kind of pictures of them with the World Cup, he almost had to be forced to have a photo with the trophy of the World Cup, the pinnacle of his career. But he leads by example because he's the hardest working and he's one of the best players. So leadership does have many forms, definitely.
Now, are you conscious, Tom, that there are few examples of female leaders in the book and in sport for you to draw upon?
Very conscious of that, actually. And it's something that, I mean, this book, so The Making of a Leader, started out as a piece of academic research. And it probably goes back four or five years doing this. And it was part of my kind of accreditation as a psychologist. So as a starting point, and this sounds like a little bit of an excuse, but actually I was limited by my network. You know, who can I reach out to? And then their network, who might they put me in touch with? But I think it's part of me thinks it's representative of a leadership sample in elite sport. It is a little bit skewed. If I was to do it again now, I would make more of a conscious effort to kind of have some female voices in there. I did reach out to Tracy Neville at the time and wasn't able to kind of get through and make that happen. And I think now, maybe with a little bit of an extended reach than I had at the time, you might look at, you know, so women's soccer or women's football, Jill Ellis at the USA, or was at the USA national team, you know, Casey Stoney at Manchester United as well, and reach out to people like that. So I think it's, on one part, I think it's a little bit, you know, down to me. I could have reached out a little bit more proactively, but also I do think there's an imbalance in those leadership roles within elite sport.
Yeah, don't beat yourself up about it too much, because I find all the leadership books that I've come across in business are, you know, it's very skewed to male leaders. And I think that's reflective of the industries and the areas that they look at. But I think it's part of the reinterpretation of what leadership means. Like you say, leadership yes. can occur at any level in a business or in any level in a sporting group. Mm-hmm. And the more nuanced forms of effective leadership, as we get more female leaders in business and in sport, you have to make a conscious effort, I think, to break out of those norms in order to bend and reshape what we see leadership as, don't we? So often leadership happens in the moment, doesn't it? Or the moment of tension that Dan Coyle writes about in the Culture Code. You use the example of an NBA game where the coach, Steve Kerr, interacts with the team's superstar, Steph Curry, who isn't having a great game, but shows that elite players are human as individuals, despite their gifts. And so all these big grandstanding moments where people take on big decisions or make, you know, big showy statements about where they're going or where their culture's going actually have to be backed up by individual moments, don't they? And can you expand upon that a bit? How do you, as a leader with a small L, make sure that you're prepared for those moments of tension where you can be a leader in that moment?
Yeah, I think arguably they're more important because you're getting more of those. I mean, moments of tension, but also just moments of leadership or moments of coaching. I think in the example that you're referring to there, so Steve Kerr, who's obviously had increased coverage as a result of the Last Dance documentary on Netflix. And it's really fascinating. You've got all these big characters in that Chicago Bulls team, Jordan, Pippen, Dennis Rodman. And Steve Kerr is the one that's leading teams to NBA titles through. And it's the clip that you're referring to, he's talking to Steph Curry and he said, "I wish I could be like you. I wish I could be as confident as you. I love it." All these words. And it's Daniel actually refers to it. And I've quoted Dan in the book because he talks about he's not coaching. He's building a bond. He's building a relationship. He's basically communicating to that player that I care about you. And Dan refers to a moment in there where Steph Curry just breaks out into this broad grin. And that's that moment where it connects with him. So this superstar, millionaire, one of the best players in the NBA, being coached in the moment and being able to pick it up on the microphone. It's just a great example of coaching. So when I'm watching a football match or a rugby match, I will look for those moments, if you can, at halftime or at full time even. Those little coaching moments where you see a real bond or a real connection between the leader in this case and one of the players. And I think now, as we're looking in business and things like that, those touch points, that impact you can have on people far away from the cameras in many cases are a real part of leadership. Probably the biggest or one of the biggest parts that I would highlight.
Well, you see it, to bring the Leeds analogy into the present day, you see it with Marcelo Bielsa at Leeds. You see the little moments he has with players and how much they look up to him. Mm. But he actually has very focused moments with them where he talks to them about what they're doing in a way that is entirely on their level. Mm. I mean, you'd see him as a leader, wouldn't you? But who is the is he the leader or the manager? Because after all, it was the club's owners who brought him in.
Are you a Leeds fan? There seems to be a bias towards Leeds questions.
How did you guess?
Well, it was easy to spot, to be fair. I think in sport, these guys, that I would say for the player, that person is the leader. Obviously, part of leadership is managing those stakeholders and having those relationships with people above you. So I think now leadership, and it depends on the organisation. So if you look at the sample we've got within the book, Ashley Giles, I interviewed him when he was at Lancashire. And he's now director of cricket at the ECB. So it's probably a very different role in terms of the specifics and managing those stakeholders as well. Whereas someone maybe like Sean, Sean Dyche, he has to manage the board and the chairman at Burnley, but fundamentally he's in charge of the team. So it depends on the different sporting context, I would say. With Bielsa and Leeds, I'd say to that player, that perception is that he is the leader. And those moments that you talk to where they really connect, and you know, I know Leeds has been a documentary, and we see a glimpse into that on some of the documentaries. But if you watch Klopp, I mean, you know, Klopp after the final whistle, and you'll see him interacting with players, his own players or the opposition at times, you can kind of see him subtly maybe adapting his style. And maybe if you look at someone like Pep Guardiola after a game, he's a little bit more, he's high energy, he's kind of. You can see almost the obsession coming out of him. Probably less extrovert than Klopp, but still maybe tailoring that communication to that individual player. And I don't think this is anything new either. I think we're just getting maybe more open in terms of sharing some of this information.
Yes, and it's even more visual because the cameras are closer to the individuals on the pitch. You see it in the interactions when someone's substituted, the end of the game, a moment, their emotions are played out in high definition, aren't they? Close up.
I think that's one of the things I would ask listeners to do next time. You know, we're going to be probably watching a lot more football because people have been maybe starved of it in recent months. And without fans and things like that, you might be able to pick more of those moments up. So quite often I'll watch a football match. I'm not that interested in the result of the game. I'm interested in those little moments, either player to player, but then player to coach as well. Or even between staff, just watch for things you can pick up and you'll see examples of people flexing that style. I mean, one of the things, you know, just going back to that kind of assumption of leadership as kind of assertive and extrovert and that charismatic leader, which I think a lot of people would put someone like Klopp in that bracket. But if you travel across Merseyside and contrast him with Ancelotti, Ancelotti's book is called Quiet Leadership, which is calm, composed, unruffled, quiet, one-to-one communication. Very, very different personalities, but I would say that both have that kind of person-centered approach that's grounded in care, really.
Yeah, it's just different styles, isn't it? And on the bench, like you say, it's fascinating to see through documentaries how people who you have an opinion of change in certain in different dynamic.
I suppose at the moment there's loads of documentaries going around because we don't have that live sport. Compare that to Euro 96, which is probably the first tournament, not that I remember, but the first tournament that I kind of really look back on and remember in detail. I remember being in tears after they got knocked out. But you look at the connection that Venables, you know, Terry Venables had with the players, and when they meet up now and they wish he could have stayed on and things like that, so that connection was really there. They were really buying into what he was about,
and they all bought into it at the same time. I think the biggest compliment you could tell from his face was when he said that the players thought he was a teacher, and you know, that obviously filled him with pride. I mean, when we boil it all down, it's about human relationships. And you talk about that isolation, that loneliness, and being able to speak to somebody or connect with people is everything about leadership. And leadership is about people, isn't it? So knowing what you know and observing what you observe, who would you say, alive or dead, is the greatest all-round leader?
Richard, that is a question. I mean, I'm going to unveil a little bit of a bias in terms of who I support. So Sir Alex Ferguson is up there, but he's probably, I think with someone like him, if you take, he was obviously tough. He was extremely competitive. It was about winning. It was about results. But it was also about compassion, and there are moments where he really cared about his people, and I think that probably governed a lot of the stuff that he did. He was able to evolve teams, move people, bring people in, promote youth, work with various assistants, various backroom staff, create a dynasty, which I think is becoming, you know, even rarer these days. So I'm going to go with him. I think I can't think past him, to be honest. He's the first name that comes to me. And I think the beauty of these questions is that you interview another 20 people and there'll be maybe not 20 answers, but 10 to 15 different answers. But he's the first one that comes to mind for me. You know, managing the Mavericks like your Cantonars, personalities like Beckham, Ronaldo, Rooney, all those things. I mean, I there are a couple of examples in the book of little moments. So before the Champions League final, wearing a 1968 replica shirt from the last time they won it. You know, little touches like that show probably an emotional intelligence that sometimes people maybe forget about that, about him, because it was about winning, and there was that aggressiveness around him. But I think underneath that, there was a real level of empathy and care as well.
Well,
I've
now,
disappointed you now as a Leeds fan, have I?
Well, I've just discovered the antipathy to all my focus on Leeds questions now, and exactly why you were steering away from them. Is that, you're a Man U fan. There you go. Well, it's nice to reach across the divide.
Books, there we go.
Connecting fans from different backgrounds. And have you read Mike Moritz's book on Alex Ferguson?
I have. I actually went to see Sir Alex. I think he was being interviewed by Dan Walker from the BBC. So I have read it, but it was when it first came out, yeah.
And finally then, well, one of the things we talk about a lot on Bokomi is that leaders, better leaders, are wider readers. Meaning they have a diverse knowledge base. Is that idea backed up by leaders in sport? Do they have a wide range of reference points for their work?
Yeah, I think the natural starting point is obviously their sport. And then it goes a little bit wider, so they start to visit other sports. So there are examples, I think Gareth Southgate, and I think Roberto Martinez went, I think Dave Brailsford went, they all travelled over to the Super Bowl in kind of 2018 maybe. Stuart Lancaster, following the World Cup, he actually went on a bit of a journey where he travelled to the Southern Hemisphere and visited Aussie Rules clubs, NRL Rugby League teams as well, spent some time with Michael Maguire at the Rabbitohs. So there is a greater sense of learning from within that sporting leadership field, and a willingness to maybe ask questions and learn from other fields, rather than that, I don't know, maybe a reluctance to do that and to kind of protect our roles at times. In terms of reading, a lot of the guys were very well read. So Gary Kirsten, we've not talked about Gary. I mean, he's obviously won the World Cup with India, record-breaking batsman with South Africa as well. Very, very big on culture. But he'd read Alex Ferguson's book about kind of managing Mavericks and no one being bigger than the club. Pep Guardiola as well, in terms of the team that he inherited and people that he moved. He referenced those people. They have big conferences now around leadership. Michael Maguire, he'll reach out and speak to people in businesses as well. So I think we often learn from, you know, people in business want to learn from sport, but it does travel both ways. And it might not be as public, but they do. So Stuart Lancaster spent time with Jim Collins, I think, who wrote Good to Great. Michael Maguire reaches out to people, Gary Kirsten as well. So there's a wider awareness of material that's out there as well. And I say that actually in my work, I think that stretches to athletes as well, not just leaders. I think some of the athletes that I work with, they'll read things and say, oh, have you seen this? Have you seen that? And it's nothing to do with golf or rally driving or anything like that. It's something to do with culture or managing people or something like that. So there's a definite greater prevalence of sharing experiences and seeking out information that is from a broader source. So Sean Dyche talked about going to see, I think it was the Oxford boat team, who had quite a basic facility in comparison to Burnley's new training ground. But one of the things that he took from that was something called maladaptive learning, where people who come to Oxford, they want to win the boat race. They might be Olympians, but they have to almost forget what they've learned about the technical element of rowing and relearn it for the boat race. And it was this concept, he related that to football, where a young player might get rewarded with a contract, but in order to get the next step and to make that step to the first team, they almost have to, that's not going to be good enough. They have to look at how they can actually improve even more. So he gave a really good example of how you learn from different environments. So I think there's a massive appetite for that throughout leadership, both within sport and looking a little bit further afield.
thanks very much for coming on the Bukomi podcast, Tom Young.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tom's book, The Making of a Leader, What Elite Sport Can Teach Us About Leadership, Management and Performance, is out now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our most wanted email at bukomi.com. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bukomi pod, please let us know by following or subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Stay safe and remember, leaders are readers. Bye for now. I love Bukomi.